This one's off? Okay. I think it's this is working, right? You can hear me? You need me to use this as well. Okay. Well, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
It's great to see your faces. I'm going to do something strange. I usually do this whenever I go to a conference. Sometimes there's 1,000 people. Sometimes there's fewer. I tend to post things on Facebook. Some of you are my Facebook friends. I also tend to tweet. So I want to take a picture of you. I'm so excited about looking at you. So I'm going to take this. I want to see some big smiles. Let's see. There's so many of you. Moving back here. All right, you ready? Big smile this side of the room. 1, 2, 3. Jesus. Great. How about this side of the room? 1, 2, 3. You ready? Smile. 1, 2, 3. Jesus. Thank you so much. I have to talk now, so it won't be up for about a couple hours. But I have a very unusual name. As you've noticed, my name is Santa Ono. And so I would love to be your friend. So you can find me on Facebook and you can friend me, and I guarantee you'll accept it. And those of you who are my friends know that I post all kinds of interesting things, including Bible verses and all kinds of things like that. I would love to be your friend. Once again, thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me to speak to the graduate faculty and ministries at the National Staff Conference. It's really fun for me to talk about universities because this is my life, being a university administrator, being a faculty member, having been a graduate student and by prerequisite an undergraduate before that. I was actually asked to talk a little bit about what's happening in the landscape of higher education and to give some perspective as to how, from my perspective as an administrator and as a Christian, we might be able to position ourselves as an organization to continue to renew campuses and to transform lives. So that's what I'm going to talk about. And I'm going to end up with another group activity where I'm going to ask all of you to stand with me at the very end, if that's okay, and repeat after me some of my favorite words from a song. I'm not going to sing it because that would be too painful for you. Maybe you guys could play the instruments and sing instead. As you've heard, I'm the Senior Vice President for Academic Affairs and Provost of the University of Cincinnati. How many of you know what a provost is? That's impressive. That's because you're in graduate faculty. If you were to ask the typical group of individuals, they have absolutely no idea what a provost is. As you probably know, at a large university like University of Cincinnati, a provost really is considered to be the chief operating officer, is often asked to run the university as the president is speaking to governors and to senators and to alumni around the country and the globe. And so I've really been having a fantastic time at the University of Cincinnati. It's an amazing school. How many of you have seen the University of Cincinnati? A lot of people. How many of you have actually seen the Bearcats play? That's pretty good. They did pretty well this year. They actually were in the NCAA tournament after having, they were in it for 16 years, and then there was a problem for 5 years, and now they're back in. And so hopefully things will continue to be exciting for the university. As you've heard, I've been there since the summer of 2010, and I was previously at a university I love dearly, and there's a lot of representation from that university. That's Emory University in Atlanta, where I really had the privilege of working with a number of people in this room with a fantastic community there. And there I was Senior Vice Provost for Undergraduate Academic Affairs, so I was really focused only on the undergraduate aspect of what goes on in a university. And now I'm responsible for, in addition to that, the faculty, the graduate students, and the professional students at the University of Cincinnati. I wanted to give you a little bit of a general background about who I am, just so you have some perspective of where these unusual remarks I'm going to make come from. I studied at the University of Chicago for my college degree in biology. Went to graduate school in Montreal at a school called McGill University. Somebody from there? You're from there?
No. Oh,
it's a beautiful place. Montreal is also a very nice city as well. And I also did a sabbatical as a faculty member in Kyoto University. And my heart goes out to my my ancestors in Japan because of all that's happened there and continues to happen there right now. I've been blessed to serve as a faculty member since 1992. For some of you, that seems like a long time ago. Some for you, seems like relatively recently. And I've served on the faculties of Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Harvard University in Boston or Cambridge, University College London, which was a particularly interesting experience before moving to Emory University and now University of Cincinnati. I therefore have a perspective about universities that's global and includes both what we refer to in higher ed speak as elite private universities, such as Johns Hopkins, Harvard, and Emory, as well as publicly funded universities such as University of Cincinnati, McGill, and University College London. For about a decade, I've been heavily involved in universities as an administrator, and as such, my job is to assess how we're doing in our core activities of teaching, research, and healthcare, and to design strategic plans to position the universities that have employed me to advance and to do progressively better. The only reason to have administrators is really to try to make things better and to really try to make the real work of the institution, that of the faculty, of the graduate students and undergraduates, to really facilitate that, because universities don't exist for administrators. They exist for scholarship and teaching. In the invitation to speak to you, I was asked to talk a little bit about where I think higher education is headed in the next few decades. In fact, I taught a course about this at Emory called The Culture of the University, which really started from the original universities in Italy and in Europe, moving into what's happening across the globe in higher education. And I was asked to articulate challenges and opportunities that I see moving ahead, and to conclude with a perspective on how organizations such as InterVarsity might help shape the campus experience, as well as to transform the lives of college students, graduate students, and faculty. And let me begin with a few comments on how colleges are predicted to change in the next two decades. And please don't hold me to this. You can never really be sure what's going to happen. but this is our most educated guess of what might happen. And actually, I gave this talk in front of the National InterVarsity staff about a year and a half ago. And I'm happy to say that many of my predictions then are actually happening right now. Many of those predictions are not very happy. I had predicted that there would be a bubble in terms of higher education financial models, and that that was not sustainable, and that ultimately there would be mergers of campuses and campuses being closed down and state budgets being cut so that that there would be tremendous pressure on university administrators. And I predicted that about a year and a half ago. And as you all know, from looking at Wisconsin and Ohio and California and Pennsylvania, and unfortunately, that's one thing I would have preferred to have been wrong about. But as you know, it's very much true. So I'm going to talk a little bit about those ideas that are in the minds of people who study institutions, and because I think it's relevant to what we do as InterVarsity. Well, one of the things that is for sure is that the number of college-age students that will matriculate at our colleges and universities and ultimately be graduate students and faculty members has begun already to decrease after a period of exceptional growth. And this is projected to fall precipitously over the next decade. It's amazing. If you actually look at the graph, it goes like this until about last year. It starts to go like this and keeps going down for quite a bit of time. And that's looking at domestic students. It's not looking at students around the globe, which is something that I'll bring up, which I think will be very important for universities and colleges as well as InterVarsity to think about as we think about what's going to happen on our campuses moving into the future. As can be seen already, we expect that this demographic will affect the total number of universities that can actually remain viable. There will likely be many small liberal arts colleges, and this has already started to happen, that will need to close during this period simply because they will not be able to attract sufficient numbers of fee-paying students to make their budgets. Similarly, a progressive decrease in state support for instruction, which is already happening, will lead to the shrinking of the multi-campus state university systems. Already happening. Just a few weeks ago, the state of Pennsylvania cut the state support of instruction and research to Pennsylvania State University, the University of Pittsburgh, and Temple University by 50%. Staggering. We were bracing for that ourselves, and luckily we were spared from that. Penn State is already, as you know, considering closing campuses. And University of Pittsburgh has to figure out a way to cut $120 million from its roughly $1.5 billion budget. I have no idea how they're going to do it. I wouldn't want to be provost there. I'm serious. I wouldn't want to be. It's a great school. I have nothing. I love the Panthers, but it's going to be tough. We expect, and I said this a year and a half ago, and people were shaking their heads, but I really believe this more, that within the next 2 decades, the number of college higher educational institutions in this country will decrease from approximately 4,000 to 3,000 in the next 20 years. 1,000 school drop in that period of time. The expectation is that what will remain are the brand name private colleges and the major flagship public universities and a tremendous continuing growth in for-profit, distance, and flexible education providers. You've already seen it happen in front of your eyes in the past 5 years. At the same time, higher education will increasingly be a global market, with the strongest institutions in this country being those that can attract the best and brightest from around the globe. Therefore, the competition will not only be about where an institution stands with respect to the U.S. News and World Report ranking of best colleges in graduate schools, but will be about where an institution stands relative to global universities in the Times Higher Education rankings of world universities. Indeed, with the demographics of university students shifting to students from Asia and India, the strongest universities will have to recruit and attract the best and brightest students and faculty members from these countries. Thanks a lot. Indeed, if you look at the proportion of international students at places such as Cambridge, MIT, Harvard, Stanford, and Berkeley, they already resemble the United Nations. For American universities to remain in the top echelon of world universities, they must intentionally attract an increasingly more global community of undergraduate and graduate students, and indeed of international scholars and faculty. Excuse me. For our domestic students, while many of our brightest students will continue to learn on our own traditional campuses, an increasing proportion of our students will select a distance or part-time or evening option for their college or continuing education. You're already seeing it happening. Of course, this shift has already occurred with an explosion of universities offering flexible education. Indeed, the University of Phoenix is already the largest university in this country. At the University of Cincinnati, this year alone, approximately $30 million in tuition was generated from distance education. We have students working towards a UC degree from around the world 24 hours a day. This movement away from campus-based education towards distance education will continue during the next 2 decades. So more and more of our students will be non-traditional and may never set foot on campus until commencement day. Regardless, these students exhibit tremendous pride and loyalty for their universities, often exceeding that of students who have had a residential experience. Although there already has been a decrease in the number of liberal arts colleges over the past 2 decades, this is unfortunately expected to accelerate in the next 2 decades. More and more students and parents are insisting on college educations to prepare them for the workplace and yield them jobs following graduation. Perhaps some of you are those parents. Just last week, Governor Kasich, the newly elected governor in Ohio, stated on a visit to our campus, and this is a quote, that we will need universities to change their curriculums to prepare students to enter the workplace. The focus must be on jobs and national competitiveness. Now, depending on whether you are an R or a D, you may agree with what he said. R for Republican, D for Democrat. Similar mandates across this country, in Wisconsin, as you know, indicate to us that there will be a continuing erosion in a number of institutions offering a traditional liberal arts education, and a shift in the curriculums of schools that continue to offer a liberal arts education. Schools such as University of Cincinnati will expand cooperative education and integrated learning programs and refine their offerings to help develop a broadly trained student with real-world experience. Now, I got to tell you, very honestly, that I was educated at the University of Chicago, a bastion of liberal arts education. So the fact that there is this mandate coming from governments isn't something that I personally endorse. In fact, I really believe that a broad liberal arts education, in many ways, is the best preparation for any vocation. But it's important for me to tell you what is really happening in higher education. There's tremendous pressure coming directly from primarily Republican governors that we have to change. I mean, they've come to our campus, sat in a room with us, and said, you will change your curriculum. He didn't say, or else, but I pretty much could understand that in the meeting. We also expect that there will be a movement away from single discipline majors or degrees to more interdisciplinary programs focused on innovation and direct applicability to future employment and national needs. Thus, fewer and fewer students will, looking into the future, in my expectation or prediction, major in just English or biology or electrical engineering. And more will enter interdisciplinary programs that expose students to several fields. The students will learn to work in teams and to solve problems as a team in preparation for their future lives in the workforce. We expect that the most successful universities will be those that integrate on-campus education with on-the-job work experience, both domestically and globally. A student will likely have multiple cooperative education experiences during their 4 to 5 years of education, with each co-op experience exposing the students to a different facet of the working world. There's tremendous pressure coming from parents, from students, and from governments to change the way we educate our students. The classroom of the future will not resemble that of today. Syllabi will be for hybrid courses, bringing together online preparation, in-class group study with an emphasis on group, or studio formats. And there's more and more desire to integrate what we do in the classroom with service learning, which I actually think is a very good thing. Social media and information technology will pervade the college classroom and connect students and faculty 24/7. This will provide students with engaging platforms for learning, the ability to learn and multitask when considering a special problem, and the ability to learn outside of the classroom. There will be less and less lecture, more and more discussion and debate. Increasingly, faculty will be expected to interact with students more, and to coach and guide students as they collaborate to consider a problem rather than walk through a problem with students simply taking notes. I actually think there's something very good about that. And I actually think that there is inherent in this shift in how we're going to educate that really could empower into varsity and the faculty and the graduate students to really connect with the undergraduates. So that's, you see why I'm sort of talking about where I think education is going? Because if we can think, be ahead of the curve, and we can think about where we're going, we can, as an institution, really think about how we can really integrate with the community and transform and renew the campus. That's why I'm taking a little bit of time talking to you about the shifts that are happening in higher education. I was stated in the Chronicle of Higher Education's recent articles entitled The College in 2020. You should really get those. They're amazing. Here's a quote from them. The internet has made most information available to everyone, and therefore faculty members must take that into consideration when teaching. There is very little that students cannot find on their own if they simply wish to walk to their computer terminal, simply if they are inspired to do so. And they are. I've seen many classes at UC where the professor will be talking about something, the Krebs cycle, and the students are sitting there with their handheld or their iPad learning about it before the words come out of the instructor's mouth. So, as I said, many of the students will be surfing the net in class. The faculty member, therefore, will be marginalized and may become less an oracle and more an organizer and a guide, a collaborator, a mentor, someone who adds perspective and context, finds the best articles and research, and sweeps away misconceptions and bad information, a sort of quality control and a safe, self-guided tour by the student in any field of knowledge. With respect to demographics, there will be a continued movement from a majority Caucasian student population to an increasingly diverse student body. Already, several campuses on the East and West Coasts are already extremely diverse. By 2030, it's projected that the majority of college students will be non-white in this nation as a whole. Therefore, the focus of student services and indeed external organizations such as InterVarsity on interfacing with a multi-ethnic student population must remain a priority moving forward. And although the campuses will be more diverse, this will also generate new tensions and challenges on our campus. And we're actually seeing that even today. Universities will need to articulate general principles of inclusiveness and tolerance on campuses and work to integrate ethnic groups on campus. Achieving such unity on our diverse campuses will not be easy, but will be important, as mutual respect learned within college can only help unify diverse groups in our society after college. I think that InterVarsity is uniquely positioned to bring unity into the diversity that occurs on campuses. Think, for example, of the racial incidents that occurred at University of California, Santa Barbara, very recently. It was InterVarsity that took the lead in actually mentoring and guiding the administration to have the right kinds of conversations on that campus that brought people together. You can read about it. Actually, at the national board meeting, we talked to the InterVarsity chapter president, the student president, or leader, and we talked to her about what happened. And she had thought about anything we could think about that they could do, InterVarsity could do, to bring that tension under control. So InterVarsity, because of its track record in multi-ethnicity, if we focus on that and we're ahead of the curve, can really play a very important role in unity on the increasingly diverse university campus. So you can see that the landscape of higher education, both across the country and globally, will change. There's nothing we can do to stop it. And that the mode of instruction within the college campus will evolve. It already is. We have a full task force made up of students and graduate students and faculty administrators that is spending scores of hours every week thinking about what the classroom will look like in the next 10 years. And we're going to invest a lot of money in the institution so that we're ahead of the curve. So when students are thinking about whether they should go to UGA or Michigan State or UC, they'll pick UC. And everybody's doing that, actually. Much of what's going on is exciting. Some of it will necessitate that we consider what new challenges will arise for our students and how we can work to protect these students as they learn not only about the arts or the sciences, but how to transition into the adult world and how to respect other faiths as they are Christian. So let's take a moment and consider several of these changes and think about how these present both challenges and opportunities moving ahead. Let's consider first the decrease in the number of schools and an increase in students learning off of traditional campuses, and that this will tend to fragment the student body in the next generation. Let's consider that for a second. While on the job or evening learning, learned locally or at a distance, will provide the needed flexibility for many to obtain a college education. And there's much for us to be thankful for that opportunity. There will be a loss of the sense of community and camaraderie that students normally obtain from a residential setting. In many cases, these individuals who are not on a residential campus will lose the experience of spending 4 to 5 years with a large group of students their own age. Since students often learn a great deal in the time between classes on weekends, there will be a growing population of students who will feel a lack of connection with their own generation. They will not be able to experience the bonding that comes with being part of a club or organization, a sorority or a fraternity, an intramural sports team, and yes, part of intervarsity, if intervarsity is going to be focused solely on the campus. Organizations that work with college-age students will need to think of new ways to connect with students who are no longer conveniently bundled onto a discrete college campus. What should this mean? Should outreach be made via both the college campus and the church? What churches or social groups should be targeted so as to retain the quality of connection between intervarsity and the college-age audience that is currently primarily on the college campus? How should intervarsity change to remain connected? Because this is a key focus of what we do as an organization. With the segmentation and fragmentation of the college-age cohort, what effect will that have on their ability to find spouses? What effect will that have on their ability to form social networks? Will a greater proportion of the next generation be lonely or mentally ill? Will fewer lives be transformed and fewer students find Christ? Let's not wait until it happens. Let's think about it and think about how we remain connected while higher education changes in the next 20 years. With the increased mobility of American students toward international universities, if you actually look at the trend data, it's amazing. More and more of our students are going to St. Andrews and Oxford and Cambridge and LSE, and even more so if you look at graduate studies. As graduate schools in Britain and Europe and Asia become stronger and stronger, more and more of our domestic students will be going to graduate schools abroad. And what will we do about that as an organization? How will this affect how we connect with these students living abroad? Should some effort be made to connect with the growing number of American students studying abroad? How can we achieve this when there are small numbers of American students on certain campuses where there might not be sufficient local leadership to support its own chapter? How must we change how we interact with the increasingly international students on our own campuses to connect with them and to transform their lives? How will the change and mix of religious beliefs on our campuses affect the dynamics between faith groups on campus? And how will it affect the psyche of the young Christian or new believer on our campus? Will the movement away from the liberal arts curriculum to one more focused on preparing students for the workforce have an effect on the campus environment? Certainly. Will the student have less time to meditate, to dream, to find God, and to consider the great questions, such as the existence of God and the role of God in creation? Will a more vocationally focused education overschedule our already busy college students and inhibit their social and spiritual growth? What can we do about that? How can university administrators and external organizations advocate for sufficient room in their curriculum for such character building and soul searching and soul defining activities? If we don't do that, do we not risk having universities without souls? To what extent should Christians within universities argue for such blocks of time within the curriculum and safe spaces for worship and meditation? What role should I play as a Christian administrator in such a dialogue? Might the movement, first from single majors to double majors and now to interdisciplinary concentrations, provide one opportunity to build such soul-strengthening activities intentionally into the college experience? Who will advocate for ethics and religion in the new college curriculum? Will it be you? Will it be the faculty? Will it be the graduate students? Will it be me? Or will it be us together? To what extent should this be led by those within the university? To what extent should it be led by external organizations? And how can we organize ourselves so that we accomplish this moving forward? It's critically important. Might one step be for organizations such as InterVarsity to involve more students as interns or to support them in service learning activities, to be a partner in the curriculum, the new curriculum that universities are designing? Might InterVarsity help students reach out to both local and global communities in their service learning activities, as they already do? But should we really think about how to make that an even larger part of what InterVarsity does? As the student population in America continues to move from one that was predominantly Caucasian to a predominantly non-white student body, how must InterVarsity change to remain connected with this changing group? Can we look at the staffing of the national organization and local chapters and say that they are as multi-ethnic as the students they work with? Can we look at the board of the national organization and can we say that it is as diverse as the student population? As our student population changes, can we say that the national staff and board are sufficiently connected with the students? I can tell you the good news is that at the board meetings we talk about this. And we are actively thinking about how to connect more with the students. So there's a change happening in the board. Have we thought enough about the programming that occurs within our chapters and asked ourselves, are there modifications we might consider to these activities that we support on our campuses that might align better with the next generation and the cultural mix that will come to be? Finally, to what extent should we be offering opportunities for ethnic-specific worship? And how might we bring these groups together to work together on God's behalf? Finally, with the enormous shifts in the use of technology in education and on our campuses, and a transition of faculty member from a single-source educator to an educational guide or mentor, how might InterVarsity change to better use technology? And a new breed of faculty members coming down the pipe to transform lives and to renew campuses. Are we using technology sufficiently and as is expected by our students? Are we sufficiently bridging our faculty and graduate students with our undergraduates so that they can not only be guides or mentors within the classroom, but in their journeys as young Christians? Shouldn't we invest more in building up our faculty and graduate programs in the coming years so that our students will see before them real role models whose paths they can follow? How might we design intentional programs to build those bridges between faculty and graduate students and our college students? We've talked about these things at the National Board and at Emory, and we've made a little bit of progress. But I say to you today that much more progress is needed, that the graduate faculty ministry is incredibly important for the future of the university. Certainly, there's much for us to think about as we try and work proactively to help position InterVarsity to continue to transform lives and to renew our campuses. I pray that in doing so, we will think of new and imaginative ways to evolve so as to connect, to remain connected with the next generation of students and to articulate with a much broader campus, a campus which is not only within this continent, but is virtual and global. But why, might you ask, should we continue to work so hard to predict and to try to align what we do with what I call the university of the future? Well, for me, the answer is simple. It's why we're all here. If we don't do that, in the context of an increasingly secular higher education landscape, there will be an increasingly large void in the lives of so many, in the soul of the university, in the soul of our country. If I look back at my life as a student at the University of Chicago and as a graduate student at McGill University in Montreal, I know I was very lost and without a moral compass. As was the case with many college students, my life was without a rudder during these years, and were it not for my meeting several Christian and, yes, InterVarsity students, I'm convinced that I would not be before you today. Like a naive child, my encounter with these Christian students brought me to a church, Bond Chapel, and to Rockefeller Chapel at the University of Chicago. And there, with virtually no knowledge about Christianity, I felt the touch of Christ every time I entered a church. And I feel that touch every time, even today, this morning. Even today, when I go to church and close my eyes, it's there that I connect with Jesus. And I feel so weak and insignificant usually, but I also feel safe because I know he's there. Over the next few years after going to college, during college, I would learn increasingly more from my friends and my wife-to-be, Wendy, about the Bible, about God, about Jesus. I would doubt and question. I would laugh and cry. But with time, I would believe. With every small step, my life would make more sense, and my life would feel more and more grounded. Through God, I began to appreciate the immensity of what He created in this universe, and through science, my belief only grew as I understood how what man knows or can even comprehend pales compared to what He created. It was through the work of InterVarsity that my life was transformed. And so the least that I can do, and I'm sure this is true for all of you, is to do the same for the next generation. Let me tell you the story of two students worth mentioning. The first one is about Joshua. I met Joshua when I gave my first testimony to an intervarsity group, Emory Christian Fellowship, at Emory University several years ago. He had arrived at campus very young, just as I did many years ago at the University of Chicago. I told them, the title of my talk then was The Three Times I Almost Died. And sadly, it was actually true. I told them about how I got off to the wrong start at Chicago, how I got involved with binge drinking and the wrong crowd as a 17-year-old freshman. I spoke of how close I came to becoming derailed and how the Lord saved me via my Christian friends. Well, a few days later, I saw him on campus and he came up to me and he said, "I just wanted you to know that I was at the same place when you spoke to me and that your speech came at just the right time." Well, Joshua has since been there for me as well. Life as an administrator can be very stressful. And there are both highs and lows almost every week. I can't tell you how many times a Facebook post from Joshua, a Christian video, or a Bible verse has kept me grounded and put things in perspective. And then there's Jake, a brilliant young man that I met last year at the University of Cincinnati. Unlike me, I grew up in an agnostic immigrant family that never went to church or read the Bible. Jake was raised by Christian parents and attended a Christian Calvary school. Well, I met Jake virtually when he wrote something on a blog of mine on the internet. It's amazing. Shows you the power of technology. I was immediately struck by his intelligence and his excellent writing. But I was also fascinated with the title of his blog, My Deconversion Event. In the blog, he described how his exposure to modern biology and genetic engineering caused him to become an atheist. There was a huge amount of traffic on that blog from his teachers, from his parents' friends, from people who didn't know him, telling him about how his life was gone and where he was going to end up after he died. Very few people who were there to talk to him seriously, right? To have a dialogue, to have a debate, to encourage him. He spoke about the rigid, unquestioning environment of his Christian school. He was actually sent to the principal's office when he actually even asked whether evolution might be possible. Can you believe that? We have since spoken in person about this, and I've given him books and encouraged him to read books such as Francis Collins' The Language of God. I told him that I, like Francis Collins, the director of this country's genome project, and now at the NIH and previously a professor at the University of Michigan, that I, like Francis Collins, became actually a stronger believer the more I studied life and realize that the miracle of life is too amazing to explain by chance, too amazing to explain by anything that can be comprehended by a mere mortal. Jake is very polite, and at present he's thinking through his own beliefs, and he needs time to do that so he can be a true believer. He's off to the NIH. I helped connect him with a colleague there, just as I did when I was his age. And I have a hunch that he will also soon realize that DNA is the language of God. So I said I was going to ask you all to stand up. We're almost there. I hope you'll view it as an opportunity to stretch. I just wanted to say, in many ways, my life has come full circle. My life is still continuing. This is not any prediction. But my life was transformed by InterVarsity, and I work to transform the lives of current students by really trying directly to renew a college campus. And I hope you can see that. So thanks for listening to me for such a long time. I spoke longer than I was supposed to, I think. I'll be happy to answer questions later, but I really need you to help join with me in repeating after me these words that mean so much to me. And I think you'll understand once I start reading them. So if you could all stand up and hold hands, I'd really appreciate it. I need a little bit of quiet, okay? Because I'm going to say a verse. I'm going to say it relatively slowly. I want all of you to take a deep breath in, a deep breath out, and think of the Lord. And this is a song that some of you might know called I Believe, Creation Calls. You ready? I'm going to say a phrase, and if you could repeat after me in unison. I have felt the wind blow.
I have felt the wind blow.
Whispering your name.
Whispering your name.
I have seen your tears fall.
I have seen your tears fall.
When I watched the rain.
When I watched the rain.
How could I say there is no God?
How could I say there is no God?
When all around creation calls.
All around creation calls.
A singing bird.
A singing bird.
A mighty tree.
A mighty tree.
The vast expanse.
The vast expanse.
Of open sea.
Of open sea.
Gazing at a bird in flight.
Gazing at a bird in flight.
Soaring through the air. Lying down beneath the stars.
Lying down beneath the stars.
I feel your presence there.
I feel your presence there.
I love to stand at ocean's shore.
I love to stand at ocean's shore.
And feel the thundering breakers roar.
And feel the thundering breakers roar.
To walk through golden fields of grain.
To walk through golden fields of grain.
With endless bloom, horizons fray.
Endless bloom, horizons fray.
Listening to a river run.
Listening to a river run.
Watering the earth.
Watering the earth.
Fragrance of a rose in bloom.
Fragrance of a rose in bloom.
A newborn's cry at birth.
A newborn's cry at birth.
I love to stand at ocean's shore.
I love to stand at ocean's shore.
And feel the thundering breakers roar.
Feel the thundering breakers roar.
To walk through golden fields of grain.
To walk through golden fields of grain.
With endless blooms, horizons fray.
With endless blooms, horizons fray.
I believe.
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 I believe just like a child.
I believe just like a child.
I believe.
I believe.
Dear friends, thanks for listening. May God bless you always. I wouldn't say it's so much. I think there's some of that that's going on. What's really driving the pressure, so you, I actually study the number of applications that come to many, many universities. Because if you don't have enough applications of a certain quality, then you won't yield a class of students that will pay a tuition, that will pay for everything that needs to be paid for with an institution. And so the drop in demographics is a key driver. If you actually look at applications to the most selective institutions, the applications are going up. And the reason why they're going up is that in focus groups, what we're hearing from students and parents is that they're willing to pay $50-something thousand a year for an Ivy League school because they think the ROI on that Harvard, Yale, Stanford, MIT brand will ultimately be worth it, because actually some of that data does suggest that they get a little bit of a jump start. The door is a little bit open for them initially. So there's a perception, right or wrong, that's worth the investment. As you go down the pecking order, even as you start to get around Emory, where I was very involved in this, the applications are staying relatively flat, and if you get below that, they're starting to go down. Because what's happening is that more and more families and students, when they're making decisions, should I send my child to the strong public flagship institution or pay much, much more money? So you can go to the University of Cincinnati for $9,000 a year. Is it really worth spending $46,000 to send them to Xavier? That kind of thing. And so when you actually see how the kids do, they get jobs from both. So then what's happening is that more people are saying, okay, well, everybody applied to the top 10, the top 15, because they're convinced there's an ROI there. But as the economy gets tight, more and more students and faculty are voting with their students and parents are voting with their feet and applying. The applications to the state schools are going up very dramatically because they've gotten stronger academically, because the students that go there can get jobs, and they say, is it really worth spending that much more money unless you get into that very elite school? Does that help you? So, yeah. Go ahead.
Working with faculty, ministry, the big, big boulder that is on their shoulders, in their offices, in their computer, in their labs, as they write and research, and in their families, is tenure. Can you speak to what kinds of changes that you see coming?
Well, tenure has been discussed for decades, as you know, and it's actually an ongoing discussion at the University of Cincinnati in Ohio. You've probably noticed that universities and state government budgets are headline news almost every day now. Wisconsin went first. Now Ohio is there. There is really a quite bit of tension. As early as this morning, I got a number of emails between university administration, faculty, where there are faculty unions and staff unions. There's a lot of tension, because what's happening is that many state budgets are in tremendous deficit. We're about $8 billion in deficit in Ohio. In California, it's hundreds of billions. And I think in Wisconsin, it's something like $6 billion or so. So it's very large numbers. And so the government, the politicians that have been elected, were elected on a platform that they would severely cut. And most of the costs are wrapped up in personnel-associated costs. And the education and healthcare parts of the budget are the two key parts. And so that's why you see things going on like at Pennsylvania, where the politicians are saying, okay, this is draconian, but we're cutting 50% of support for universities. Same kinds of things are happening with benefits, because benefits for university, often, university salaries tend to be a little bit lower than in the private sector, but the positive side is the benefits are usually much more generous than in the private sector. But to make the state budget, there is serious legislation on the books in many states to actually make universities much more efficient, to eliminate collective bargaining, to try to break down unions, to decrease benefits. And yes, in some cases, even to reconsider what tenure means. So currently, tenure in most institutions, once you have it, unless you do something terrible, you can retain your job. And there is, it's illegal to actually transition somebody out, even if they're very advanced in age. It's considered age discrimination. But the other sorts of models that, this is not me personally considering, but other institutions are considering, to deal with their budget crunch, is to have new negotiations with faculty governance to decrease what tenure means. Because once you're locked into those salaries with tenure, there's very little flexibility in the university budget. And so there's a lot of administrators that are trying to say, okay, you can have tenure. Tenure was defined to protect intellectual freedom, right? But some are saying, you know, and some are using the argument that some faculty become less productive, and they have tenure, so there's not really much of a incentive to remain as productive as they were prior to tenure, right? And that really depends upon the faculty. There's some faculty like that, and there's some faculty that even after tenure are very productive. But the economic driver, and also the view that some faculty are less productive after tenure is resulting in some conversations about changing tenure from being lifelong to being more of a rolling tenure format, so that you have post-tenure review, and the tenure is reconsidered at, say, five-year blocks. And so that if you're tenured at the age of 35, say at 45, you haven't been teaching, your teaching evaluations are bad, and you're not publishing books or articles, then at a post-tenure review, you could lose your tenure. And so that the driver of that is really to have excellence in teaching, but also ensure that there's efficiency, that the teachers are really being productive scholars and also being effective teachers. So there is an active debate going on right now, and it's quite, you can imagine, it's quite emotional, because the faculty don't want to lose this tremendous tenure that doesn't exist in most of the other organizations in the world. Does that answer your question? Yeah, go ahead. Academic vocation in light of faith. I thought you were going to ask me in light of their job prospects. Well, that's a good question. Let me first start saying that in talking to lots of graduate students over the years, would say there's been quite a clear shift. It used to be that everybody that was trying to get a PhD or a doctorate wanted to become a university professor. And you probably know in your own campuses that's decreasing. The students, some of them don't want to do that because they don't want to go through what's considered to be a very pressure-packed tenuring process where you're examined very carefully. So I think some students are moving away from becoming faculty because they don't want to go through that, what they consider a rat race. It is very difficult. There are others who are no longer interested in being faculty members because they think they can make more money using that doctorate to be in the industry, in a pharmaceutical company, or to work for a law firm or things like that. So there are increasing numbers of graduate students that are moving away from the path to being a faculty member. Now, your question is, how has that affected their courage in being Christian, right? Now, that's a really good question. And I can answer it with an example. I think it really depends upon where the student is, which institution they're at. I learned something, I'll use this as an example. I learned something about my appointment at the University of Cincinnati after I was appointed. And I told Alec Hill about this. And I met a member of the search committee afterward who was a graduate student. There was the graduate student on the search committee. And after the four finalists, I was one of the four finalists, came on campus, there was a lot of chatter about which one should we pick, you know? And so one of the threads in the graduate student blog or whatever was, do we really want to have a Christian as provost? Because there's no divinity school at Cincinnati. It really is a secular institution. And so there was a back and forth. I was fascinated. I had no idea that my appointment could be jeopardized by being, I'm not shy. I am Christian. Everybody knows that. I tweet it. I put it on Facebook. I talk in front of audiences. Sometimes I'm on YouTube talking about my love of Christ. So I am not shy. And they knew about that at Emory. They knew about it when I was applying for the job in Cincinnati. Amazing that I think, to answer your question, the reason why some graduate students and some junior faculty are amazed or at the fact that I'm very open about it is that some of them are afraid that it might hurt them. There are faculty in many institutions that would frown upon a junior faculty member or a graduate student being an evangelical Christian. No doubt about it. I'm in a pretty protected situation at my level because I'm a tenured professor and I'm the provost of the university. So, but I'm not fully protected. I could be criticized. So that's something that hopefully answers your question in a sort of an indirect way. But I wanted to say that actually, and I think this was probably mentioned in the previous talk, I've experienced a shift, even in the past 5 to 10 years. Not too many people attack me for being Christian. What happened in that thread is one student said, do we really want to have an evangelical Christian to be a provost of a secular university? But what she told me was overwhelmingly, 5 to 1, people wrote back saying, why not? Why shouldn't our administrators be Christians or Jews or Muslims? Why not? They're human beings. And they also said, doesn't it help educate the society, the community of the university, to see people who are practicing their faith? So I really think there's been a shift. I haven't actually been in any way, to my knowledge, damaged by being. So we had a faculty group at Emory, and there's someone I really adore in that group who is actually a Catholic priest. And we talked about this over lunch, and he used the term because of this concern about being some way discriminated by being Christian on a secular campus. Which is actually largely Jewish. Emory is largely Jewish. He said it might be important to be a stealth Christian. That is to be a Christian inside, to be there for students and graduate students that need you in a very discreet way, to be a Christian in stealth. This is by a priest. I actually don't think that's necessary anymore. I think you can be really Christian and be proud of it, I think. Yeah. Yeah, go ahead. I don't know how to choose. Go ahead, Carrie.
I was actually going to ask for this because it really was a good meeting. I think in order to do what we're trying to do for UV University, we need people like you. You are a gift. So it's very important to.
Thank you. Thank you.
So my question is, how do you do it? Do you have a network of
Well, you already do. I don't have a group of Christian provosts. there are provosts and presidents that are Christian. President Jim Wagner at Emory, he talks about his faith, and so maybe we should get them together. Good idea. That's a good idea. That's a great idea. Yeah. That's a great idea. But just to answer your question, who helps me?
Who do you talk to about this?
Who's your support?
Well, Christ, but beyond human beings, beyond that, actually, you'd be amazed, and I think Glenn knows this. It's the people of the university community. They are so loving and supportive. And I told you about Joshua. So But there's Gary, and there's Glenn, and there's lots of people in the community that are there. So I don't feel lonely in any way.
That's what I was
thinking. Yeah. Go ahead.
Last one.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. Where he says that the jobs that they're being trained for are ultimately, not sustainable either personally or economically. They're all being trained to become white-collar cubicle jobs.
Well, they're also industrial designers making cars. There's quite a breadth of activity. But carry on.
I'm just wondering, are any of the universities, you think, going to look at things like saying, well, actually, we're going to train you to be a own road and plumbing organization or to be a contractor or something like that?
Yeah.
Or is that wide swath going to be left out?
Well, we actually have a construction management program at the University of Cincinnati.
Okay.
Do you want to be a student there? All right. but to answer your question, I want to be very clear about this. When I'm talking about this trend, I actually don't think, I think it's dangerous. You're looking at somebody who went to the University of Chicago, liberal arts bastion. There is a danger, I think, in completely occupying the curriculum of a student with just engineering, just design, just the co-op experience. These young people between the ages of 17 and 21 need time to meditate and think about the great questions that they will define their soul. And without that, there will be no soul within the university. So I'll do everything I can in working with the faculty and thinking about our curriculum. Yes, we can enrich paths, create paths or tracks that will empower them to be successful once they enter the workforce. But we have to make sure that there's a very solid, serious component for reading the great books and really looking into one's soul and thinking about the values of being a human being and citizen. It's incredibly important. Thank you.
Thank you.